Welcome to the Alcohol Free Life podcast, brought to you by thesoberclub.com. I'm Genuinely Grace. This is for you if you've quit the booze or you'd like to, or maybe you're just sober curious. I'll bring you tips and motivation without any judgment, and there'll be inspiration from experts, quitlet authors, and sober heroes. Hi, and welcome to the podcast. I hope you're well. I hope you're enjoying the snow if you have some in your area. I remember years ago we had an au pair come over from Australia. She was 22 and she'd never seen snow, and it was just so cute to see her reaction. So if you've got young kids, I hope you're enjoying the snow, if you've got any in your part of the world. This week we have teamed up with Everleaf, and I interviewed Paul a while ago on the podcast, and I thought it'd be great to give this fabulous brand another mention. But just before I do that, introduce as well our guest for this week, Dr. Arik Sigmund. I just absolutely love his work. He's a health educator. He speaks in schools. He's an author. His book, Alcohol Nation, was, oh my goodness, made such an impact on me when I was still drinking. But I didn't want that for my children. And of course, you will have seen the piece in the press not that long ago about the legal age for drinking, which apparently is 5. I mean, come on. So we're going to talk about that. Of course, we're not suggesting that most parents are throwing booze down their kids at age 5, but it sets the tone, doesn't it? So I'm going to be chatting with Dr. Arik Sigmund. And on that note, it was interesting because I found a piece in the press this week as well, talking about a study that shows that drinking 3 glasses, they say, but you know, words the effect of drinking too much, in inverted commas, could be in your DNA. They're saying the amount of alcohol that you drink is significantly influenced by your genes. I thought this was such a worrying study, actually. You know, they're basically saying it will be influenced by genes, and it could add as many as 3 drinks to someone's average weekly consumption. So researchers were looking at genetic analysis for people. They're basically saying that, interestingly enough, they're saying that people from a white European background consume the most. And they're saying, they do say, we can't entirely blame our genes, as behaviour is very important in drinking behaviours. And it is possible for people to decide to cut down on alcohol and lead a healthy life. But what they're basically saying is people with this higher genetic score were putting away, as they put it in this article, more drinks than they want to. I hate those kind of studies because, you know, what is this trying to say? Yet again, it's trying to say, oh, you know, it's not your, in inverted commas, fault. It's just who you are. It's just in your genes. You know, you drink too much because it's in your genes. Well, you know what? It as that study touches upon, yes, there may be some genetic predisposition to many things, but it's absolutely not set. There is very little, actually, genetically that's set. Almost everything can be changed. If you don't believe me, look at the work of Dr. Bruce Lipton. Absolutely fantastic studies in this arena. But don't fall for these studies. I'm only saying it so enthusiastically, because of course I used to look at a study like that and go, oh God, there you go, it's in my genes. Of course it is, it's in my genes, it's the fault of my genes, it's been passed on to me, therefore, you know, it's, I can't help it, it's just who I am, I have to just keep on drinking alcohol. Well, it's not true, is it? It's a learned behaviour. Drinking alcohol is not genetic, it's a learned behaviour. We get the idea at some point along the line that, oh, well, this makes me feel a bit more confident, or this, I'm along with down with the other people in my main arena in life. If I do this, you know, I'm down with the kids. I'll be more popular. I'll be sexier. I'll be this. I'll be that. You know, we somehow get these ideas And it ramps up. It doesn't have to be who we are, right? So for every one of these ridiculous articles, how about they just spend some time researching how much better life is without booze? How about that? You know, let's have a bit of research around that. The number of people who report their absolute incredible gratitude at being free from this ridiculous alcohol trap, right? And it's a self-imposed trap. It's not our genes. We can choose to be free. I saw in the week, Jamie Lee Curtis did that piece about how grateful she is for her sobriety. Just wonderful to see this stuff. Dr. Alex has gone sober. I don't know if you saw that on Instagram. And of course, Russell Brand has been talking more about his sobriety. If you haven't before, by the way, do check out Russell talking about his book Recovery. His take on the 12 steps is just absolutely fantastic. Yeah, as long as you're not easily offended. Let me tell you about Everleaf. They make non-alcoholic aperitifs, which rival some of the greatest alcohol brands on the market. Created by conservation biologist and bartender Paul Matthew, who I interviewed a few months ago, as I say. He's been working in the drinks industry for 25 years, so he really knows his stuff around drinks. So he launched Everleaf in January 2019 to meet demand from his guests for great non-alcoholic options with the flavour, complexity and texture of the best spirits in the world. And he used his knowledge of plants to help deliver that. I remember when I interviewed Paul, we had a really interesting conversation because when someone comes from that conservation background, they really know about sustainability. They really know about flavour profiles and plants. And since then, the brand's grown to three flavours, and it's available in 8 countries. And it is one of the best-selling non-alcohol brands in the UK. So they've got the 3 products anchored to different parts of the natural world, the forest, the mountain, and marine. And they act as inspiration for the flavour profiles and the sources for the key botanicals. So I love this. There's so much depth to this brand. It really is amazing when you think about how much Paul knows about botany and conservation. And of course, it's a drink that you can mix with a tonic water, you can add ice and garnish it, create a spritz, you can make a really lovely alcohol-free cocktail. When we had our self-care and sobriety retreat at Champneys, they now have Everleaf, which I was super impressed to see. So we had a lovely alcohol-free cocktail with our meal. So just to remind you of the blends that they have, then the products they have. Forest is, they describe it as complex and bittersweet, a blend of 14 sustainably sourced botanicals to capture the essence of forest. So it's flavours like vanilla and saffron and pink peppercorn and fennel and cinnamon and licorice. You get the idea. And then marine is a crisp blend of 16 sustainably sourced botanicals, and that captures marine flavours. So in there, you've got sea buckthorn, kelp seaweed, juniper, elderflower, eucalyptus pine, and many more. And then mountain, a blend of 12 sustainably sourced botanicals, which capture mountain, including flavours like strawberry, myrtle, coriander, cherry. What else is in that one? Juniper. That one, by the way, it's crafted, they say, for pink gin drinkers. And it's absolutely lovely. It's a great alternative if you used to drink pink gin or if you used to drink rosé. And they look really pretty, these bottles. Now, they have a new Christmas collection, which, of course, you don't have to have it on Christmas Day. You can have it any time. But the Christmas collection is perfect if you do want to get some in for Christmas. So it's an offer that includes a little bottle of each non-alcoholic aperitif. So you get the Everleaf Forest, Everleaf Mountain, and the Everleaf Marine. Plus, you get an Everleaf Jigger, which is a fantastic word. That's worth it for the name alone. An Everleaf Jigger and a bar spoon. So if you go to everleafdrinks.com, you can find all the information there. Grab yourself some Everleaf. And we have a competition as well to win that Christmas collection. So make sure you check out thesoberclub.com and also on our site, imperfectlynatural.com. You can find more information about Everleaf and you can enter our competition to win that Christmas collection. So
I'm so pleased that my guest is Dr. Arik Sigmund, a health education lecturer. Arik has specialises in trying to prevent physical and mental health problems. We've chatted to him before, and I'm really looking forward to finding out more about the work that Arik's doing, not least because of an article that hit the press. I'm sure most of us saw it. It made big headlines, the story about the legal age for drinking, which I think shocked everyone, which was published in the British Medical Journal Archives of Disease in Childhood, with the very technical title, Pediatricians Can Reduce Future Alcohol-Related Morbidity and something else, I've forgotten.
Mortality, which means death.
Death. Yeah, exactly. Well, that's a lovely, cheery start.
Absolutely.
Welcome. It's really great to chat to you. I really wanted to get you back on the podcast. It's been a long time since we've had a chat. And of course, that piece went absolutely everywhere. We'll talk about it in a moment. But before we do that, just give us a little bit of a lowdown on you and a little bit about your background and the work you do, just in case anyone hasn't come across your fabulous work before.
No, I wouldn't have thought they would. I spend my time trying to prevent problems, particularly in children and adolescents. I know there's a lot of talk, for example, with mental health about resources, supporting children, raising awareness. It's very important we try to prevent a lot of the problems that we hear about. So my job is prevention, and it's a wide variety of subjects, everything from trying to reduce children's screen time, use of computer games and social media, to preventing eating disorders and body dissatisfaction, vaping, trying to prevent that, raising awareness about the effects of cannabis, which people are not hearing about, all the way to trying to do sex education for boys in particular, because of the Me Too movement, boys have been sort of left out and not really very well understood. So I deal with those areas, and I do it by speaking directly to children at schools. I speak to their parents and or the staff. I speak at medical schools, and I publish medical papers the rest of the time, or reports or books on these sorts of subjects.
Now, I know that many years ago you wrote Alcohol Nation. Just tell us a little bit about that book.
Yeah, I noticed as an American, as you know, we have a health problem. It's called guns. Americans love guns. You read about it in the news every couple of weeks. It's in their blood, and they don't want to give them up. And I notice in this country, you don't like guns very much, but you do like alcohol. And when I started to look at the major cultural differences, and also some of the legal differences, and the differences in terms of medical advice between America and this country, particularly when it comes to children and the age at which we introduce them to alcohol, our attitudes towards it, and our attitudes towards drinking in public on trains and walking down the street with a bottle of wine or beer, they're markedly different between the countries. And when I started to then look at the consequences of that in terms of, you know, teenage binge drinking and many of the diseases, I thought it was important to write a book for parents and teachers and so on, trying to redress the terrible, terrible misunderstanding that people in this country have about how best to prevent future alcohol problems in children and adolescents, so that when they are 25, 35, 45, all the way till their 80s, how can we reduce any possibility of them ever having an alcohol problem? And that can happen when they're young. That's when we have the biggest opportunity to prevent lifetime problems in alcohol use.
Well, I know that, you know, many years ago we met when you came to speak at my the school that my kids were at. Now, back then, I was still drinking. So I was in that, you know, awful situation of, you know, trying to model one kind of behavior and actually wanting my kids to try another. So, you know, hats off. I feel, you know, that's my only regret, that I didn't stop drinking sooner. It really is. But back then, I remember that, you know, I was still drinking, but it felt very important to me that my then young teenage
kids didn't start too soon. I intrinsically knew how important that was. And I remember hearing you talk, and your talks are fantastic. If anyone's listening, book Eric, he's just brilliant. And I know the kids, my boys, really loved your talk because you're totally relatable to the kids. But I know something you said to us as adults was you reminded us that, you know, the brain is not fully formed till what, 2021?
So 25.
Is it 25? Wow.
And some people are now arguing 30.
Wow.
Yeah.
And we just don't pay enough attention to that. So anything that we're doing, like pouring in, you know, excessive amounts of toxins, is going to be so damaging early on. So even if you do choose to do it later, and of course I would argue, why would you? Now we know. But even if you do choose to do this as an adult, don't do it when you're a kid, right?
Yeah. I mean, ultimately, the message to all teenagers, and I was speaking to a group of 15-year-old girls yesterday, was to say, I'm afraid getting drunk is an adult pastime, which unfortunately, Janie, if you and I go out binge drinking right now, you and I know it's not good for our health. But just because we're over 25, at least I assume you are, I certainly am, because we're over 25, our brains and bodies are fully formed and we can take it better than somebody who is younger. And that's the main difference. You're absolutely right. The things that children or adolescents expose their brains to affect the size, shape, and function of those brains. And binge drinking is one of the big ones. And even just moderate drinking causes the changes in the shape of brain cells in areas of the brain which are involved in lifetime addictions. So we now know about the mechanics, and it isn't just a cultural argument anymore or a lifestyle series of options about you can do it this way with your children, I choose to do it that way. There are some biological realities that we now do understand, and they are to do, as you rightly said, to do with brain function, brain shape, and future development.
Yeah. And so in this piece that that you've just published that made the headlines, the reason it made the headlines is because you identified something that I don't think any of us knew, that actually the legal age for drinking is five. I mean, now I know that it got the shock factor, it got the headlines, didn't it? I don't suppose that the reality is that many parents are sitting there going, well, I'd really love to give my kid a drink, but is it legal at five? You know, if it is, I'll do it. I don't think it's exactly that. But I guess what you're saying is this needs to be changed. Let's raise awareness so that's because what message does that even send?
Yeah, exactly. And I have no interest, and I do not like the idea of criminalizing parents, but I wanted to raise awareness that there's a cultural, I suppose, a laxness towards, or in fact, a whole dislike of having to think about when do we introduce our children to alcohol. And by pointing out the fact that it's legally allowed at five, while people are very, very concerned in other parts of Britain about, you know, putting mothers in handcuffs who might slap their child on the wrist, it's considered an assault now. I believe it's Scotland and some other countries have made swatting your child on the hand or the bottom, a criminal offense technically. They're spending a lot of time on that. While laws about allowing your kids to drink when they're five, if you really want to, nobody has any interest in talking about. And I felt it was important to point to that as an opening for this country to discuss our attitude towards introducing children of any ages to alcohol. I don't know any parents who give their five-year-olds alcohol. However, I must say, Janie, when I first came to Britain, I remember when infants cried, mother is used to produce this magical clear water called griping water.
Griped water, I think it was called.
Yeah, and they give them this griped water on the train or wherever they were, and the babies would sleep and go silent. And I thought, what a miraculous
invention.
What
the hell's in it?
Yeah, I thought, I'm going to tell the Americans about this. And I looked at the ingredients. Of course, it was booze.
No, really? Yeah.
It's got alcohol in it.
Oh, my God.
Yeah, not anymore. Of course, they haven't done it. They've stopped that. But there's always been a very different, almost more European attitude towards alcohol in this country. And so I thought by starting the conversation saying, look, it's currently five, don't want to criminalize parents, don't want mothers and fathers in handcuffs, but let's just reset the cultural landscape so people do see introducing our children to alcohol, not owned by culture anymore or by country's history, but by child medicine, pediatrics. It really shouldn't be owned by our culture. This is an issue which is now medical, and we need to own it as health professionals, not the culture, and certainly not the alcohol industry, who has run the show so far.
Yeah, I mean, I totally agree. But even just this phrase of introducing our children to alcohol, this is what really drives me bonkers. I remember once I had stopped drinking, going to a talk at my another one of my children's schools when she was, I think, 13 or 12 or 13. And the talk for parents was all about at what age, you know, let's have awareness of drugs and alcohol. And at what age is it a good idea? Is it a good idea to introduce, you know, a glass of wine to get them used to it? What absolute BS. I mean, why? It's a drug. It happens to be a legal drug. We can argue about that separately. But it's a drug. We wouldn't be having the same conversation about introducing our children or teenagers to just a little bit of heroin to get them used to it. Right. We would never have that conversation. So why are we doing it with alcohol? It's as if it's literally fait accompli. They have to drink. They live in the UK. It's what you do. When you get to 18, you're going to be rocking it big time. So we may as well give you a bit with Sunday lunch. And then we can hope that everything will be good by the time you start binging. It's absolute nonsense.
You're one of the few people that's ever verbalized it in that way. And you are absolutely right that if you and I didn't want our children to end up as cocaine addicts, you wouldn't ask me, oh, dear, Eric, would you please teach my children sensible snorting? Build up the tolerance so that they know how to handle their coke when they're older. Yeah. Or as you said, heroin, learn how to handle your heroin with sensible shooting up lessons. No, we know that there's a medical principle that the earlier you introduce any teenager to any addictive substance, the more likely they are to end up addicted to it, except alcohol, where we said the opposite. No. You need to introduce it, you know, in mid or early adolescence to get them used to it. It's utterly false. It's been completely disproved. And much of it comes back to the misunderstanding of the so-called continental French family approach to teaching your children to drink. Mm. Now, many people in this country, and I have to tell you, I lived in France for a year, and I was
France. That's very interesting, yes.
Yeah, I was in France, lecturing a couple of weeks ago.
Well, because we do have this thing that I do still hear people say, oh, I know your views and everything, but people in France don't have any problem. They drink differently to us, and therefore they don't have any problem. I'm not sure I believe that.
Well, they're absolutely right, Janie. They are different from us. They die at a 26% higher rate of death from alcohol than we do.
Don't know about that?
Yeah, funny enough.
How come they just sip a bit of wine with their lunch?
It's extraordinary. This is the terrible misunderstanding. Oh, wow. That a couple of things which I published in my medical paper. One of them was looking at the death rate. And the death rate from alcohol is 26% higher in France. And these are World Health Organization statistics. Secondly, there's a medical measurement called years of life lost. From alcohol, the French have more years of life lost, and the French per person drink more alcohol than we do in this country every year.
Wow, that's
and the French government has now raised the drinking age. And secondly, they've launched
to what? What have they raised it to?
They've raised it to 18.
Okay, interesting. Yep.
And then you want to go to a bar or something, you've got to be 18, and that's the way it is. The interesting thing is Public Health France, the government, has launched an attack on French alcohol. And they've actually said that they want to detrimentalize the image of alcohol in France to reduce death and disease. So the French government are not happy about French drinking. They know there's an enormous problem, and it's us and some other countries who wrongly misinterpret the French. And it stems from this, I think, that we wrongly confuse alcohol and French drinking with antisocial behavior. We see ourselves in this country as standing in front of a fish and chip shop late on a Saturday night, headbutting one another after having too much to drink. Binge drinking, antisocial behavior. The French simply behave
better. Oh, it's so much more elegant, isn't it?
Yes, when they're drunk, they simply behave better than you do. That's just where we've gone wrong. It doesn't mean that they don't like the tortoise and the hare. They don't have a tippling problem. Mm. And they do, that they start earlier in their lives, earlier in the day. They don't overdo it all at once between 8 and 10, but ultimately reach middle age and they cross the finishing line for things like death and liver disease and many other things. So don't confuse behavior and binge drinking with general alcohol problems. Mm. That's one of the problems. Mm. And certainly don't copy the French when it comes to preventing your children from ever developing an alcohol problem.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, of course, this comes back to, it's cultural, as we say, it's a done thing, it's that rite of passage, isn't it? Oh, when he's 18, my son can come down the pub with me. Absolute BS. But part of the problem as well is, of course, the economical one and the fact that there is a lot of money to be made in alcohol. So, presumably our government, who, by the way, don't mind a bit of booze themselves, I think we all might have noticed over the last couple of years, unbelievable, that whole lockdown BS. Oh, my God. I mean, what kind of message were the governments really sending there? Honestly, I mean, really. Anyways, that's another topic. But, they're not going to want to pull the plug on this or start to admit just how terrible it really is, because they're making a shed load of money.
Yep. I think the term they used to use was sin tax, that basically governments make a lot of money off of the tax from alcohol. And so that's one very good reason. And the alcohol industry is an extremely powerful lobby. There was just an expose in a big time medical journal done by top medical schools in London, and they examined all the alcohol education materials that you see as a parent and the schools get and the booklets and the videos. And they found that most of the stuff is financed by the alcohol industry and none of the schools know it. In fact, the title of their paper was called Distilling the Curriculum. And they found that the alcohol so-called charities, which are supposed to be objective, neutral organizations, funded by the alcohol industry. And when they analyzed the messages, as you rightly say, Janie, the one thing that came through was that they discussed with families and children in schools the fact that drinking is an inevitability in our children's lives. Mm. There was never any option of not drinking. And they played down the links with cancer and addiction and other things. So the doctors are not happy about who is delivering the alcohol education. And governments don't seem to stand in the way really about that for the reasons that you explained.
Yeah. And as a psychologist, you will absolutely know that the link between alcohol and mental health issues, it cannot be denied. No one ever talks about it. You've heard me say it before, but I just get incensed that so many of my clients, so many women, of a certain age will rock up to a GP and say, I've got anxiety, I've got mood swings, I'm feeling stressed, I'm feeling anxious. And they're signed off with antidepressants immediately, probably forever, unless they ask to come off them. It's just a repeat prescription. And they're not asked about their drinking. And some of these people are on a bottle of wine a night. Yeah. So how can that be a good balance of medication?
Oh, it's a good way. If you want to guarantee yourself a depression, drinking a lot is a good way to do it. And again, it's a misunderstanding. We understand mental health and alcohol as follows. I become depressed or you become depressed. You order a double whiskey to drown your sorrows. Mm-hmm. So the depression is first and the alcohol deals with the depression. That is possible, but it also can work the other way around. It's called bidirectional causation, meaning you can be a relatively happy person. You drink too much, particularly binge drinking, you can cause brain changes, which can cause a clinical depression. It works both ways. And this is not being made clear. We also know it's true, by the way, with cannabis. Yeah. And this is particularly so with younger people while their brains are still forming. So alcohol can cause mental health problems, and it's not being made clear. It isn't just the result of a mental health problem.
Yeah. Absolutely. And the other thing, we were just talking about the money that's being made. It's interesting, isn't it, that when you look at the way alcohol is marketed, you know, in the UK. I mean, it's everywhere. And again, I know we've said this before, but you try and buy a birthday card for your 21-year-old son. I mean, you know, it's bottles of beer or it's a football. That's it. You ain't got any other options. You know, you try and buy a Mother's Day gift and, you know, there's nothing that doesn't say Prosecco on it. So it really is part of our, it's seen as, you know, the happy place, isn't it? And it's so linked to celebrations and commiserations and everything in between. But funnily enough, the alcohol companies never use their customers in their marketing, do they? You never actually see that image of the people outside the chippy or the bar or, you know, throwing up in the gutter. They don't actually show you how people feel after they've imbibed. It's funny that, right?
No, what they do is to put a very, very small little sentence, which you can hardly read at the bottom of their advert, saying,
drink responsibly. Yeah. Absolute nonsense, honestly. Wow. Well, it's amazing the work you're doing. I mean, what would you like to see happen as a result of this piece that you wrote? It was for the British Medical Journal. So I suppose ultimately you wrote it for paediatricians and for the medical profession. What changes would you like to see within the medical profession?
Well, in short, what I'd like the medical profession to do, particularly pediatricians, is to feel as if they can wrest control back of ownership of this subject and take it away from the alcohol industry and from the culture and to say, look, this is a child health issue. We now own it. And as follows, this is what I believe that they need to do. First of all, I think they need to educate parents. I think they need to dispel the French drinking myth and make it absolutely clear that by delaying the age at which you introduce children to alcohol, you are more likely to reduce their lifetime risk of ever having any kind of alcohol problem.
Yeah.
As opposed to what they currently believe is that if you don't give them small amounts, they see it as a forbidden fruit and they're far more likely to rebel. It's just not true. This is one of the terrible fallacies that has been propagated by the alcohol industry, that by delaying the age at which your kids have alcohol, there's going to be a backlash. They're more likely to end up with a problem. No, they're not. Also, to disapprove of underage drinking, parents should be told that. The NHS has said this for quite some time. Parents who disapprove of underage drinking are more likely to have children who don't drink underage, or at least they drink less when they're older. So parents need to regain control as well. And I think that doctors and all health professionals can help them feel, so-called empowered to do that kind of thing. Another kind of thing is they need to realize, as you rightly mentioned, is that role modeling is terribly important. Enough studies have shown that parents who drink a lot in front of their children, monkey see, monkey do, they're more likely to do the same thing. One of the things that we parents need to understand that it isn't just getting drunk in front of our children. Even with 3 and 4 year olds, they know the reasons we're drinking. So if you blindfold a 3 or 4 year old and you pass various smells underneath their nose, they will prefer the smell of rotten fish to alcohol. If one of their parents, particularly their mothers, is an escape drinker. In other words, if you come home and say, oh, I could just kill for a pint, or I'm dying for a glass of wine after a day at work, little kids pick up on that self-medication. Yeah. So it's not the amount, it's the context. And parents need to be aware of the self-medication messages so their children don't grow up learning, hey, I'm under stress, answer, get a drink. So that's another point I think should be made clear as
that's
well.
That's such an important point just on that topic. I mean, we hear from children of alcoholic parents, and really the trauma just cannot be underestimated. It's, I mean, really just any more work that can be done around that is hugely important, isn't it?
Yeah. I strongly suggest that there should be mandatory warnings on all alcohol products and any kind of so-called health promotion materials stating that delaying the age of alcohol initiation may reduce children's lifetime risks of alcohol use disorders, including binge drinking, while allowing or teaching underage adolescents to drink may actually lead to brain changes that could increase their lifetime risk of alcohol use disorders, and also raising their later risks for a large number of diseases. And this is compatible with the NHS advice at the moment. People don't realize that the NHS has made it clear, quote, children and young people are advised not to drink alcohol before the age of 18. Mm. Alcohol use during the teenage years is related to a wide range of health and social problems. So putting that on the back will make parents realize. And I think we have to have trust in parents, that parents love their children. I sound like Borat. Parents love their children. And if the rationale is explained to them as to why delaying the introduction of alcohol is a good thing, they'll do it.
Yeah, it makes sense.
They found it with passive smoking. 2 years before the laws were ever brought in, parents started to hear that passive smoking in front of your kids isn't good for their health. And there was a dramatic reduction, including the dramatic reduction amongst people who were very poorly educated and people who were very, very poor, the ones that people assume aren't going to get the message. It's not true. They did, and they reduced the passive smoking. So we need to trust that parents will actually do that. And to stand back from this, you know, alcohol remains the leading risk factor for premature death and disability for people between 15 and 49 years.
Wow, does it really?
Yeah, absolutely. Year after year it is. And the World Health Organization says that, quote, it's a causal factor in more than 200 disease and injury conditions. So this is not just a lifestyle cultural argument, and these are some of the things that we can actually do. I also think that there should be measures to get rid of the so-called alcohol lobby influence in schools. That if you and I didn't want our children, and this was the case a long time ago with the sugar industry, that sugar companies used to come into schools and give the nutrition lessons until people thought, hold on for a second, who are these people? What are the messages they're giving? But now alcohol is being given by the experts, and the experts are the alcohol companies, which is a conflict of interest. So that needs to be dealt with as well. And I think by some of the measures that I've just mentioned, you look forward 10 years from now, there will be a very significant drop in many of the problems we're seeing at the moment. Just by simple measures, particularly by informing parents and leaving it to them to implement these new ideas within their families. A decade from now, we'll have fewer problems.
Well, yeah, I hope so. And particularly if, you know, the message that I and many other people now are getting across, which is that, you know, alcohol isn't this forbidden fruit that we all have to look forward to, but actually the emperor isn't wearing any clothes. Yeah. Life is better without any alcohol. If only someone had told me that sooner, right? If only when I went to the GP, you know, for something else and then admitted, actually, you know what, I'm a bit worried about my drinking. If only the answer had been, great, let me signpost you somewhere where you can get off this stuff and have freedom, instead of, oh, well, you seem fine, just have the odd alcohol-free day, You know, how about changing that stuff so that we don't have this goddamn fixation that we, that alcohol has to be part of our lives? It doesn't.
No, and unfortunately, whenever someone like you says that, right away, people somehow think that you're almost an evangelist, that you're an oddity, and that the option of saying, I don't want to drink, is just considered socially awkward and so on. Or in my case, when I publish medical papers like this, people see me as some sort of new temperance movement.
Yeah.
Like the American pilgrims who left England because they hated alcohol. Instead of just seeing it as a health and development issue, it's nothing more than that. And I'm afraid, you know, that you and I should be more likely to own this subject and to see it as such. But unfortunately, as you say, our lives, or British lives, are so dependent upon alcohol for romance. People feel uncomfortable meeting people for romance unless they're slightly tipsy and feel less self-conscious.
Yeah.
And any kind of family gathering at Christmas or whatever, in order to get along well, of course, we all know it ends up with rows when people drink too much, but people feel that they can relax with their families more easily if they're just slightly tipsy. This is a problem, because if it's considered an integral part of normal, everyday emotional and social intercourse, it's very hard to extract it from those lives. But I think if you look at many other things over the centuries, you know, things like opium, things like Coke, and almost all kinds of other things were considered part of everyday life at one point. And then people thought, actually, they're not very good for you.
No, exactly.
So there needs to be a reconsideration. One thing I would like to add which I take for granted because I know it, is that the real reason we want a delay in the age at which children have alcohol is because we now understand how their brains change when we give it to them, and we didn't understand that before. And in short, this is what seems to happen. There's a couple of things. One of them is that children have got addiction genes in their brains. We want them to remain rather dormant, asleep. However, we now realize if they're introduced to alcohol, particularly under the age of 16, it's more likely to switch on those genes, to upregulate those genes, making the alcohol more rewarding and addictive than it would otherwise be. And that's what's changed everything. So the longer they can leave it, I mean, ideally 25, but we all know that's not going to happen right now. But the longer they can leave it, the less likely they are to, what we say, sensitize the neurocircuitry of addiction. And when you look at what that means, when they look, and they're doing this in things like mice, which are the very acceptable model to make decisions about teenage drinking, you look at mouse brains, one night of drinking causes changes in the actual shape of the brain cells in the addiction areas of the brain. And those scientists in the world's top science journal believe this may then cause future alcohol dependence in the years to come. So it's a mechanical process. Brains are vulnerable, and that's why we want a delay in the age at which kids start drinking. It doesn't get them used to it. It's more likely to actually enhance the addiction process.
Yeah, really, really fascinating. Thank you so much, Erica. It's brilliant the work that you're doing. And you know, we haven't got time to get into it, but all the other stuff as well, you know, the stuff about vaping and the screen time and the, I mean, all of this stuff, someone needs to speak out about it. They really do. So
you don't get a lot of thanks for it, I can tell you. If you tell people or kids to do less of their favorite things, you get some pretty negative payback. But if you do what I do for a living, which is try to prevent problems, you don't tell people what they're interested in hearing, you tell them what is in their children's best interest. Yeah. And it's not a popular thing, but it's a necessary thing.
It is. And I know you do it in an extremely relatable way. So yeah, I appreciate that. So yeah, if anyone listening, you know, I mean, honestly, if the best thing you can do if you're a parent is just go to your school and tell them, book Eric, book Eric Sigmund to come and do a talk.
That's very kind of you.
And for the kids, right?
It's very kind of you because I absolutely hate marketing. I love doing what I do and I love the research and the writing the papers, but I'm very shy when it comes to blowing bugles and marketing. So if you want to do that for me, Janie, thank you very much.
Because that's what's needed. I know it made a difference to my kids, because I seem to remember you told the boys, I think they were about 13 or 14. And I overheard one of my boys saying, he reckons that if you drink too much, you can't get it up.
It's funny how
you know, that's the bit he's going to remember, right?
Yeah, it makes them stand up to attention, even if something else won't.
Yeah, but that's the kind of stuff they need to know.
Yeah,
because you have to be. Alcohol is presented as so glamorous, but actually it isn't glamorous. And yes, it will cause erectile dysfunction and everything else.
Yeah, well, I think they're probably used to people saying, "Oh, hello, my name is Brian Chipple. I would like you to desist from," instead of being less woke and more bloke and telling it the way it is. Yeah,
yeah. No, I very much appreciate it. So anyways, ericsigmund.com. Thank you, Eric. I really appreciate it. And let's talk again soon. Maybe we'll get you back on and have a chat about some of the other stuff, because you know, I think people, you know, once you ditch the booze, once you start to become a bit more awake and aware of living a bit more holistically, actually you probably do want to look at all these other layers for yourself and your family. So yeah, let's get you back on at some point.
Happy to
really appreciate it. Thank you.
Good. You take it easy.
Thank you, Eric. We'll make sure we put links to your books in the show notes. I wanted to mention that we have a great prize draw happening at the moment, raising funds for the Sober Club Give Back Fund, which supports people who can no longer afford membership or need emergency, in inverted commas, coaching. It's a really good cause. We match every penny that goes in there as well, so it's a bit of a win-win. And so we thought we'd do a really nice prize draw. And because, as you know, my take on everything is the holistic picture. So I reckon that once you ditch the booze, you probably also want to start thinking about great skincare and natural cleaning products and all kinds of lovely stuff that also doesn't involve really nasty chemicals and alcohol. Who wants, you know, face cream with alcohol in it, right? So we have an absolutely huge hamper of beautiful natural, some organic, some completely natural, all sustainable, gorgeous skincare and beauty products worth over 500 quid. So this is just the most perfect gift for yourself just before Christmas. And all you have to do is donate to our prize draw, and you can be entered with a chance to win our massive hamper. This is sadly for UK only because we just can't post it anywhere else. So sadly, this one's just for UK listeners. And the really good news is that we've asked you to donate a fiver, or you can buy more tickets, of course, if you want to. But you also get, everybody who makes a little donation and enters the prize draw gets our alcohol-free cocktail making video tutorial. So you get to watch someone whizzing up different cocktails, which I always think it's really helpful if you get to watch someone do it. I'm not very good at just following recipes. And that's worth $9.99. So what's not to like, right? So if you just go to thesoberclub.com, you can click on the blog post, or you can click on the kind of news screeny thing that goes across the top and enter our prize draw. You have to do it soon, though, because we're going to be closing it, obviously, beginning of next week, so that we can try and get the prize to the winner before Christmas. There's a couple of runners-up prizes as well, a Bath Time Bliss kit and some alcohol-free drinks. So it's definitely worth a shot, and you get the little alcohol-free vid-making tutorial as well. So thesoberclub.com, obviously that's the address if you want connection, if you want to be supported. If you are doing this thing just before Christmas, I have one client who has literally made her commitment, and she's starting now. And she said to me, oh, you know, I don't know if it's a good time. Yes, it's the perfect time. You can literally be fully present for Christmas. There's nothing better than that. And remember, there is nothing to give up. You are only gaining. You're only gaining. And you will absolutely have a better Christmas if you do it without the booze. No two ways about it. So if you are doing this, get yourself some support. Let someone know. Drop me a message. I'll be your cheerleader. Obviously, I'd love it if you wanted to join us in the Sober Club. So much support there. So much inspiration. Whatever stage you're at, we've got people in the club who've been sober 7, 8 years, because now they're unwrapping something else, another layer, another fabulous part of themselves, you know, getting back to who they really are without the toxic liquid. So check out thesoberclub.com. Check out our prize draw. Pop the date of the 1st of Jan in your diary if you want to join us for an online, I don't know what to call it really, kind of 2023 inspirational masterclass stroke retreat online. I'll tell you more details about that as soon as I've got my act together, but pop the date in the diary, save the date for now. Final mention, if you are thinking of becoming a sober coach, I've mentioned it before, this is the training that I now offer. Our January course is completely full, but we will be commencing another program in March. The price, the investment is going up, but if you make connection before the end of the year, then we'll hold the prices the same. So if that's something that you've been thinking about, you're thinking, you know, maybe 2023, it really is time for me to step out and support other people, then just drop me a message. We can have a chat. So have yourself a great week, and stay connected, stay in touch. We'll see you next time. Thank you for listening to the Alcohol Free Life podcast, brought to you by The Sober Club. Please rate and review. And if you want support, accountability and inspiration, and you want to live your best life without the booze, check out thesoberclub.com.